Stuff that's got to go. In my meeting, we thought we knew what good and what Christian looked like. We thought we knew what it dressed like. I think as people trying to not be Laodicean, we need to reach the point where we stop disagreeing with the source of all good, the judge of all the earth, about what is good, what is fair, how we're doing, and our ability to properly be what we are created to be. As to getting into heaven, unchurched folk have to lay aside, "But I tried as hard as I could," and "That's too hard," and "But he made me," and "But that's not fair," and "You wouldn't throw the book at a guy like me," and "Saint Pete wouldn't turn me away from heaven," and so on. To us, they sound like 10-year-olds. Perhaps harder still, we Christians have to lay aside, "If I follow along with my church culture, imitating the outer forms of devout people, I just might be able to meet God's exacting standards for what a Christian is supposed to be, or close enough that he won't do his job and call it like it is. And then maybe he'll like me and bless me today." Christ or Christianity? That's a much finer distinction to make than drunken, lying, thieving sex addict or Christian. Yet it was a distinction I certainly had to make. Time to review some stuff. Like I've said, what God did in incarnation as Jesus was to lay aside his right to judge and his place as God and take on a body and a human position with all of its temptations, stressors, and limits. He then walked around, not judging, not saying any of the things that would signal that he was closing the book on humans and giving up. And instead, he spent his time talking to people and putting out his hand and offering healing, insight, wisdom, forgiveness, and helping to get them started on a better path. You know, stuff that we're supposed to do for people we meet, even though we're not the Son of God. Best of all, Jesus offered to alleviate each person's duty to meet God's impossible standard as codified in the Mosaic Law. He didn't deny that the people he spoke to had sins, nor did he require them to make amends for them. He didn't say, "Stop sinning right now, and if you do, your past sins will then be forgiven you." He just told them their sins were forgiven without them doing anything at all. Often they were just looking to have a crippled leg healed, and he offered the forgiveness of sins unasked. Jesus lived a whole human life, not as God who judges, having given that position up for a time, but as God down here living a human life so we can get to know him better. For our part, as human beings, we have the chance to live no longer as human beings who fail and are judged if we can't meet God's standards. We have to live our lives having given that up or died to it, as the Apostle Paul would put it. We have to live as children God is helping out and showing stuff to, which is obviously awesome. We get a learner's permit for life. God becomes driving instructor rather than driver's test administrator. God as Jesus is born human and goes around studiously not being God, so it's a fair demonstration of humanity. He says things like, "Why callest thou me good? There is none good but one, that is God." He tells us to be born anew, to live our daily lives as new creatures. People who are no longer claiming, nor are responsible, to meet God's quite reasonable, but quite beyond us, standards for how a being created in his image should respond, both to him and to others like created. Because he's going to help us grow toward that, not by pretending to be better, not by vowing to act as if we were better, not by punishing ourselves with shame every time we're not better, by being made better by God, our Maker. Is Romans 7 the best we can hope for? When Paul writes to the Romans, the part we tend to call chapter 7 has a section which artistically paints the picture of a human being who has fully realized his own limits, a man who is now fully in possession of the understanding that he's not going to be able to satisfy God without the help that is offered from on high. The description is very clear. Paul can will, want, or decide to do good things, vow to be strong and kind and wise and meek, but all he's got is his current self to try to do it and be it with, his limited willpower and insight and heart, his flesh. The term "the flesh" is a metaphoric description of man at his flawed best, falling short and being incomplete despite his best efforts, trying to be a perfect creature of spirit, but being a meatbag in the end. It's failing to walk according to what is, to what God wants and what would be good. With only the flesh to rely on, man is too weak, too childish, too foolish, too dark, too incomplete, too blind, and too twisted to deliver on these good things with any consistency. The flesh loves carefully put together systems and plans and vows. It loves statements of intent that it will never deliver upon, empty mission and vision statements, ambitious resolutions. It loves committees making lofty plans. Human beings know that having theft and adultery, drug addiction, prostitution, child molestation, robbery, poverty, and the exploitation of others in the world are bad, bad things. We know that having generosity, charity, safety, fidelity, health, and comfort for everyone would be really good. We agree about all that, no matter who we are. What we can never agree upon is precisely how to fix the bad and make things good, because we don't actually know how, nor are we willing or able to do what it would take. We work, we do research, we donate money, we have meetings, we raise awareness, and the world remains messed up. We act like we can legislate or fund morality and spiritual health, which isn't working out very well. And what is true on a global level is also true on an individual level. Man knows what good would be, but can't be it, despite any number of plans, vows, and rules. He knows what bad is, and can't stop being it and being involved in it. There is no human system on the individual or global level that's going to fix things. We can't even fix our systems, let alone what they themselves are designed to fix. Not hospitals, not jails, not governments, not schools, not churches, not charity organizations. We need God. Every time Paul says, "I hereby resolve to be better in this way, and not do or want to do any of these bad things anymore," he then finds that there is something rotten right through at the core of his infrastructure. He finds that he is weak and corrupted, and it all goes wrong every time eventually. The best of intentions fail to materialize in the harsh light of day, and troubling tendencies toward dark, petty, weird, destructive behavior are seen. The law of Moses is good in that it perfectly presents a codified picture of what God expects as a bare minimum from his children. It does not primarily present how to be good. It mainly presents how not to be bad. Not how to excel, just avoiding what would constitute failure. The best it can offer is, if one were somehow able to keep from doing the things it describes as bad, then one has not done bad. Zero sum. You're just not bad. The Mosaic Law does not justify a man, nor can any human-created one. A few people who claimed to have kept the law came and spoke to Jesus. Each one felt keenly that despite keeping the law, something was missing. Kept isn't as good as fulfilled the reason for their even being the law. They hadn't broken rules, but they didn't get it. They hadn't done bad things, but this didn't make them good people who did good things. God knew what he was doing when he didn't lay a responsibility to be good or perfect on the Israelites. He was making a big point that human beings couldn't even keep from doing bad, stupid, and weak things throughout their lives. Not without help, without collaboration and cooperation from him. Point taken. What now, though? Spoiler, the law can be summed up in terms of loving one's God and one's neighbor. Failures to keep the law are failures to love. And love that merely keeps us from hurting, exploiting, or ignoring others isn't very impressive love at all. Shadow self. One of Carl Jung's contributions to modern psychotherapy is the idea of a shadow self. The concept is simply this. There are parts of our personalities, of our inner selves, which we can't face. We are tempted to pretend they do not exist. There are habits or choices we are secretly drawn to, which we want to tell ourselves we actually detest. Sounds a bit like Romans 7 already. And it's up to us what percentage of our unflattering inner selves we will pretend does not exist and will refuse to deal with. The more of these darker parts of us we push far back into the blackest corners of ourselves, the more they are off our radar and will do whatever they like back there in the dark. They usually start repeatedly manifesting in troubling ways which are as much a surprise to us as to anyone looking on. The sum total of this rejected self stuff forms what Jung thought of as one's shadow self. We create a strong shadow self by consigning a really significant part of us to supposed non-existence, pretending none of that's really real, or at least nothing we're going to be looking at or thinking about, or that we can handle it by repressing it rather than coming to terms with it. What this will do is to cause us to project, so that the dark parts of our own selves are soon all we can see in others. Our eyes become full of all that darkness. The more we fail to accept the very existence of these darker parts of ourselves, the more we meet our own weaknesses everywhere we turn, in everyone we meet. Paul speaks of a concept quite like the Jungian shadow self when he writes, "For I know that in me, that is in my flesh, dwelleth no good thing," and further explains, "For the good that I would, I do not. But the evil that I would not, that I do." He expresses how easy it is to have noble ambitions and resolve to achieve them, but how impossible it is to live as if the darkness were not present in him and actually do that. In a bit of a Yoda-like way, he says, "For to will is present with me, but how to perform that which is good, I find not." No matter how lofty, religious, scientific, or sensible the plan to improve, no matter how heartfelt the vow to do it, all comes down to wishful thinking and empty New Year's resolutions in the end. It all comes down to pretending we have more say than we really do in what we will and actually do and feel in the near future. Eventually, the best-laid plans of mice and men go seriously sideways. The answer to Paul's dilemma is not acts of piety or the imitation of outer forms of religious behavior. It is not renewed vows, self-flagellation, penitence, law, religion, self-loathing, and agonizing over his own wretchedness. It is not pretending that he can just say no when he ought to. Instead, he reaches out for the hand of God extended to him at the end of Christ's arm to help Paul in this very situation. God comes to earth as Jesus to say, "Here, you're doing it wrong. This is how it's done. It's not the letter, but the spirit of it that's the key. And it's love. The letter kills, it will condemn you, but the spirit of God's love that I manifest here is intuitively grasped. Try it. It is quite contagious, and the truth of it able to set you free from all of this. So relax a bit and stick with me. We'll get it all worked out." To further step apart from the rigid, adversarial roles that aren't helping, by his actions, God says to his children, "You have the knowledge of good and evil. You can identify them. No longer innocent, you don't feel very good about yourself, and you feel naked before me. But I'd like to help. If you agree to stop trying to handle all this yourself, if you stop relying on hiding in the bushes and wearing fig leaf aprons to try to fix your existential problem, I'd be overjoyed to remove from you that responsibility to independently manage to do good rather than evil. Then we'll move ahead under a completely different understanding, in a completely different relationship. That's going to do a much better job of getting us both where we want. I call this innovation grace." Paul thanks God that through him, in the form of Jesus Christ, Paul is delivered from the unenviable position he is in. He no longer lives a life haunted by the fact that without any help from God, he will screw up. He's accepted that he will screw up, admitted it. God and Paul have agreed that this is the case and have decided to work together to deal with it. God, as Jesus, has redirected any of the judgment that God as judge would otherwise be responsible to aim Paul's way onto himself. Sin isn't any longer just Paul's problem. It's their problem. And God has come here as Christ to deal with it. And it's dealt with. So Paul screws up. He steals an O. Henry bar from Walmart. He loses his temper with someone who doesn't deserve it, feels superior to that poor soul, and cusses him out just to feel better about himself. The whole time, he lusts after the wife of someone he knows, rather than going and winning the heart of a woman he can then call wife. As a human being, equipped with the stolen knowledge of good and evil, he knows that all this isn't good. If things with God hadn't all changed, he'd be in some real trouble now. He'd be completely responsible to not do and be that fleshly, sinful, stupid, mean kind of person. His true nature revealed to be not as advertised, he'd stand accused, convicted, and awaiting punishment. But the punishment is gone. Even the accusation is gone. You see, Paul is no longer responsible to never sin. He has laid aside that responsibility, that understanding, that ground, that role. This doesn't mean that if he sins or acts stupid, weak, corrupt, or fleshly, that this is now a good thing. It doesn't mean that his failure isn't bad. But it isn't anymore Paul's obligation to never do bad things or else. Together, he and God can address the root of the problem, where the stupid, mean, and bad actions come from. He can grow increasingly into a person who shows more and more of the loving spirit of Christ and is less and less mean, angry, weak, and corrupt. And while he grows, the pressure is off because he's got as many mulligans, as many do-overs, as he needs. This is called grace. It doesn't make sinning okay. It just means we have a special arrangement whereby when we do things that aren't okay, it's handled. It is very possible for Paul to lose sight of his new arrangement with God and God's new role in his life. It's possible for Paul to start mistakenly reckoning himself to be that same old person, the one who didn't have the arrangement with God. It's possible for Paul to start to live as if Christ had not come, to take up the responsibility to be good on his own, armed with religious activity, to start trying to save himself again. It is very possible for him to, quite apart from God, adopt a bunch of ritualistic behaviors intended to brainwash him into stopping doing the bad things that he genuinely, deep down, actually wants to do and doesn't know why. To try to shove all that dark, weak stuff down where no one can see it, hoping that will get him through the day. To start building a truly terrifyingly large shadow self, rather than working with God to redeem his inner self. The more Paul cuts himself off from parts of his real, imperfect inner self, the more divided he becomes. Jesus pointed out that a house divided against itself will fall. He said this as part of explaining how stupid the sensible accusation that he was casting demons out of people by using demonic power was. Jung really has a point about the shadow self thing. Men love darkness rather than light, Jesus said, because their deeds are evil. When you've got something to hide, you love having secrets, taboo topics, and lots of shadows to stand in. Jesus said this. Sometime later, Robert Louis Stevenson wrote The Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde about a man who tries to scientifically remove all the dark, ugly, and bad parts of himself. He hopes to use drugs that will ensure that only the good, handsome, and noble parts of him will be seen. In so doing, he repeatedly becomes and lets loose an ugly, violent, selfish little monster on the city. Whoops! Then he tries to oppress that evil, weird, dark little self, which just makes it go on nightly rampages in the dark. When religion tries the same thing in real life that Henry Jekyll tried in science fiction, exactly the same result is seen. Failed attempts to control the uncontrollable. Moving in religious circles can very quickly engender competitive piety, resulting in pretense, in repression, in self-delusion, self-ignorance.